Người đã về cầu đi chân rai đã đi khai ta đã lên Krishna Krishna Bhaktai ta Bhaktai Namo Very short, spacious invocation, condensed, invoking the blessings of Guru, Gauranga, Radha and Krishna, all bhaktas. And every time I think of bhaktas, the person will think about those who are bhaktas and those who they're not yet bhaktas, right? So it includes everyone basically. Because you ultimately we are all bhaktas in potential. Those are officially bhaktas that born the way, those who eventually will embrace love. So a beautiful way to encompass all of existence and beg their blessings for today's sharing. So, good evening again. Welcome again. Respect, look anew. Let's rediscover each other after a few hours again. And today we are having one more meeting, our penultimate meeting. Tomorrow morning we'll have the last sharing in the morning. But today, after talking about various topics, and after today in the morning talking about listening and presence and holding space, as a natural continuation, hopefully you felt a natural continuation of topics like vulnerability and how to express bhakti in everyday life, smallest actions. And since one of the main themes of the retreat is embodiment, so let's talk about the body. So we want to talk about the body as a temple. That's the theme of today's sharing. The body as a temple. The subtitle was Spirituality Beyond Shame. And each of these titles require a separate retreat of their own. But we'll try to say something about it. So on one side, the body as a temple, and in connection to that, spirituality beyond shame. So somehow the hint is there. Sometimes we may feel shameful, or we may be ashamed in connection to the physical dimension, or to connecting with the physical dimension. So how to, yeah, we were talking today in the morning, holding sacred space, how to hold sacred space in our body. And to begin with, beginning from the most immediate reality. And of course, we may be quick to tell we are not our body. We are the soul. We are not the body. We know. We know in theory. But that doesn't mean that we need to reject the body or mistreat the body or downplay the body or neglect the body or shame the body. Because we are talking about dimensions of existence, and in each one of these dimensions, Krishna is fully present. So, if the divine is fully present in every possible dimension of existence, how can we shame that? That will be aparad. That will be an offense against God's presence everywhere. No? That's something that we explored, say the other day. A few weeks ago, we were in Austria and we did a retreat there called What is an Art and Nibriti? Really? And we explored one category of anarthas that Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes. And he says, the anartha is called Tattvabhi Brahma, which means to be confused about reality, to do not know what is what. And he then subdivides Tattvabhi Brahma in four. He says to be confused about what's love, who is God, who we are, and what's the world of matter. To have wrong ideas, toxic beliefs about each of these is an anartha. It's an obstacle, it's an undesired element of the path. So somehow we'll go today a little bit into the realm of the of matter, into the physical existence, into the material world, and all that's related there. And let's see if we can find something sacred there. or everything is sacred. Let's see how the exploration goes. But personally, I think it's very important to be to make peace with our body, so to say. Because how, as we were talking these days, how can I be at peace with others if I'm in war with myself, or with certain dimensions of physical, mental, emotional existence? No, if there is no full acceptance, full integration, full respect, that's what we're talking these days. So for me personally, a very important aspect of the spiritual journey is integrating humanity with divinity. As Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we are invited to be fully human and fully divine at the same time. And as we were celebrating yesterday, in Haridas Thakur's disappearance day, he left his body, and you could say that was a material body. Disgusting, low stuff. I'm dramatizing a little bit. But Mahaprabhu took that disgusting bad stuff in his arms, embraced it, he danced with it, he bathed that, he put himself into samadhi, he organized celebration to honor that, the sacredness of that body, someone who used matter in a holy, sacred way in connection to the divine. So Mahaprabhu was not rejecting, oh, I won't touch this body, is material, is dead, I will get contaminated. He was born as a Muslim. No, I'm a Hindu. No, all these relative considerations were not there. He just saw, here is a fully spiritualized body. It's worshipable for me. So we are invited to integrate, to spiritualize each of our dimensions, bodily dimension, mental dimension, emotional dimension. When that happens, when we invite bhakti to pervade all our faculties, everything becomes spiritualized. So we no longer need to say, I'm not this body. Well, in fact, it is described in our tradition at the moment of initiation, guru gives the disciple a sadaka deha. We have heard about Siddha Deha, but before speaking about Siddha Deha, you need to know what to do with your Sadaka Deha, which is the body of a practitioner. Guru imparts mantra and name and a whole series of orientations to see your body in a different way. This is the body of a practitioner of bhakti. This is a sacred vehicle and vessel to be engaged in service. So it's no longer my body or whatever. It's a sacred instrument. And the more I act accordingly, that body becomes fully imbued with bhakti to the point that it is said that in the version of that spiritualized body, you can serve Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in his Gaur-lila in eternity. That's why in our tradition, the body of someone like Haridas Thakur or some other acharyas are put into what we call samadhi. How the body is preserved in salts and all these elements, trying to make the point, in a version of that body, that person still exists and is serving in eternity. So how much we can say, oh, that's bad, inferior, whatever. But again, sometimes we get the wrong belief, thinking, no, matter is something bad, something to be rejected, something inferior. And I've seen that sequence played out many times, especially in the Vaishnav community, but I can imagine it happens everywhere. If we get this wrong idea that matter is bad, then there's a whole sequence following that. Matter is bad, material life is bad, married life is bad, working is bad, having a body is bad, sex is bad, having kids is bad, all, no? A whole sequence, a whole like snowball effect. All that is anti-transcendental, right? Something like that. That's the opposite of what it should be. But it happens that 90.9% of people go in that direction. So imagine you enter a life thinking, oh, I'm entering a spiritual aspirant in this ashram, which is anti-transcendental, it won't work very nicely. That's what we were talking, I think, yesterday. I was speaking with one disciple of Srila Prabhupada that works with couples, and she told me more than 90% of the couples who were disciples of Srila Prabhupada, they end up in divorce. More than 90%. That's a number. That's almost 100%. Let's put it that way. And which was the reason? Too much emphasis on renunciation and detachment. You are not this body. This is inferior. They will get married and immediately be introduced to, okay, welcome to the dark well of family life. Oh. And the husband will tell the wife, okay, we're getting married, but in 25 years I'm accepting vanaprastha and going to the forest. If you begin your married life like that, I mean, that's the beginning of the end right there. I can guarantee you. And once I was told that in one marriage celebration, and we are laughing again, not to cry, this is tragic. A couple was married and they gave to the husband a rope and a lantern. Lantern?
Yeah.
Flashlight?
Flash.
He's like, for what? Because you are now in the dark well of family life. So you need light in that darkness and a rope to get out of there as soon as possible. That's my marriage gift to you. So again, no wonder then, oh, almost 100% of the marriages fail. Of course, if you start from that place, it's utterly dysfunctional.
And then children should be born into this mood.
Imagine, but you expect your children to be a Prahlad Maharaj that redeems 7 generations back. No? But you are treating that kid as Hiranyakashipu treated Prahlad, basically. And then why they are behaving like, well, again, and this is not to blame some particular people, groups, individuals, just to analyze and learn from history. And I will say at the root of all that is this misconception that things material are bad. Whatever is in connection to this world is bad. And we develop this mukti-oriented practice. We are here to get out of here. But that's not our practice. The goal of our tradition is not mukti, it's not moksha, it's prema. Other traditions have moksha as their goal. We do not. Actually, our tradition considers moksha kaitava dharma, cheating in the name of religion. Imagine. So we despise mukti. We are not practicing bhakti as an evacuation plan in the afterlife. I'm doing this here now so I get out of here as soon as possible. That's not what our tradition teaches. Go to Shikshastakam. We spoke yesterday, verse 1, 2, 3. Go to verse 4. What does Mahaprabhu is saying? Mamajanmani janmanishwari bhavatad bhakti rahaitu kitai. Janmani, Janmanishwar, over and I can take birth over and over again here. It's okay. Bhakti, as long as I can offer myself in service to Bhagavan, I can engage in bhakti. I don't care for being born. Again, I don't care coming to this world because what's this world? Again, when we say material world, it doesn't have to do with Mother Earth, it has to do with a certain type of consciousness. Because Krishna comes to earth over and over again to perform his lila. So this cannot be that bad. Right? He's choosing, oh, after he finishes the lila on planet Earth, he appears on another planet Earth and on another without stop. So in one sense, Krishna is always on planet Earth in one way or another. So how bad is this place? People, well, to speak, if you want to relate to Krishna in eternity and you choose, oh, I want to join you in your earthly pastimes. You will be on earth forever. I'm trying to give you some paradigm shift so we can analyze these ideas from a different place. Keshavacharya raised his hand a few minutes ago.
Yeah, like Prabhupada, I heard him saying that in the beginning we should desire to actually get out of here. He said that in the beginning.
But here I'm surrounded by not a group of beginners. So we are taking that on another level. And again, when he will say, get out of here, what the here means, right? Of course, again, as you say in the beginning, here is like this place is so bad, but actually here is material consciousness, no? Self-centered, exploitative. That's it, get out of here. Because Prabhupada was walking with us on earth, but I don't think we will say he was entangled in the material world. We will say he was in the spiritual world. No, he was in Switzerland and in New York. No, that's external. Internally, he was somewhere else. So then what's here? Is it bodily geography, or is where we are inhabiting in our consciousness?
But he was in New York, and he said it was a heavy place in that sense. So
and he was, he said,
he was in New York,
yeah.
He said it's a heavy place. In
that a heavy place.
Yes.
Yeah. But also he was in New York, and many times he was looking out of the, and he was perceiving suddenly spiritual world. He was having these visions in New York. So I'm not denying that he was historically, physically in New York, but we know he was somewhere else internally. That's the point, right? That when we say here, there, sometimes it's not so much geographically located, but where we are inhabiting in terms of consciousness. So yeah, I think that many times we have overemphasized, for example, we are celebrating today Mahaprabhu's Sannyas Lila. I'll go there in a moment again. And we sometimes overemphasize renunciation from a toxic place. You know? Like again, like if renunciation is the goal of our life. If, as I said before, we think liberation is the goal of life. It's not. Renunciation is the goal of life. It's not. The goal of life is just for you to relax. It's not to become a sannyasi. No, so you can relax a little bit. No. That's not the goal of life. Nowhere. I mean, we want to serve in Golok Vrindavan. There are no sannyasi there. I better do not attach myself too much to be a sannyasi, because at one point I have to let go of my sannyas if I want to enter Golok Vrindavan. I can't enter Golok Vrindavan. I want to remain being Padmanabha. So that will disturb the whole Leela. Take all these sannyasis out of the village. If sannyasis come to the Leela, is it Urvasamo, some sage that comes and everyone is scared, they may curse us, he may get angry. It's a source of anxiety. All these monks, and you let keep them out, send them somewhere else. So better we don't get too attached. It's an upadhi. It's a limiting adjunct. It's a designation. I'm a sannyasi. Yeah, on some level, yeah. On some level, Mahaprabhu said, Yatirba, I'm not a sannyasi. Mm-hmm. So by this idea of matter is intrinsically bad, we extend that body is bad, humanity is bad, having a family is bad, work, children, all that is by extension damned, profane. But if we get it right from the beginning, matter is sacred. Oh, that changes the whole picture. Mm-hmm. And this is a topic that I consider very important. I wrote the last chapter of my last two books, actually, on matter, interestingly. The last chapter of Radical Personalism, which is the longest, is all about the sacredness of matter. And the last chapter of my last book, Evolution, Divine Love, is all about matter. I feel we need to pound this post. In Sanskrit, they have this idea, this maxim called Stuna Nikanana Nyaya, which means the law, the maxim of pounding the post. If you want to pound the post, you don't put the post and do tuk and you leave. It's like one, two, three, so it's fixed, right? You're putting like a, you want to put a picture. So sometimes we need to say some things a few times, more than once, right? Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ayubakiva, Kalona, Nasi. It's not that Vyasadev was stuttering or something, that's some problem. Why are you saying that again? That probably we need to hear that again a few times. So in that way, you know, there are many, many, many sections in our scripture which speak about the sacredness of matter. I mean, matter is a Shakti, material energy. It's a Shakti, it's a potency which exists in the service of the potent Bhagavan. So matter is in service of Krishna. That's stated throughout the scripture. Matter is not against Krishna. Now, here we don't have this theology of matter or Maya is like the devil in Christianity who is trying to go against God. Maya is in service of Krishna. We are the ones who are not in service of Krishna sometimes. So Maya is more in service to Krishna than us. Then let's not get that wrong, right? And Maya is not trying to make us fall from service of Krishna. Maya is there just to facilitate the result of our actions. I mean, we need to have free will to love Krishna voluntarily, but when we choose to not love Krishna, then there has to be a department that facilitates our choice, and that's called Maya Shakti. But the scriptures say Maya is embarrassed and she has to do that. In other words, she will like to do something else, but someone has to do that. Okay, sometimes the best servants are the ones who are assigned the hardest roles to play. The best actors are the ones who play the villain, as they say, right? Like sometimes there is these alternative versions to Judas in Christianity. Srila Siddhartha Maharaj will give that perspective that comes in the what's called an apocryphal gospel of Judas, where it is said that actually Judas was the most advanced disciple of Jesus. And Jesus knew someone has to betray me, but that person will be condemned for the rest of eternity. So who is willing to do that? I will be praised and worshiped and glorified, but that person will be hated by most and misunderstood by most. And Jesus said, I do that for in your service. So the best disciple will have to do the worst things, so to say. So that way, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments in one famous verse of the Bhagavatam, that the verse of the Bhagavatam, second canto, says, the more you meditate on material energy and the interaction between Krishna and material energy, the more you become disentangled from the influence of illusions. So Bhagavatam is encouraging us to meditate on matter in connection to God from the proper perspective. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments to that verse saying, material energy is a Vaishnavi with the highest devotion, with surrender to Krishna, a great devotee with the highest love. So if we dare to say, oh, this material energy is so, you are committing Vaishnavi aparath. You are offending a great devotee of Bhagavan. No? This world is horrible. All this matter of good. She's dedicated to serve Krishna more than us, probably. That's what I like to say sometimes. Sometimes we think, okay, this flower is made of material energy. So I will make a favor to this flower and I will offer this flower to Krishna. So this material energy becomes connected in service. No. Material energy is already connected in service. I am the one missing the party. So this material energy in the form of a flower allows me to be connected in service by me, you offering the flower. But I am the one being offered through the offering of the flower. So I'm not doing a favor to the flower. The flower is doing a favor to me because material energy is already engaged in service of Krishna. I am the one who is not doing that yet. So it's another way of changing our angle of vision and honoring and respecting, again, respect. Look anew. In Brahma Samhita, what is Krishna saying? Govinda Madhi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. Govinda is saying, Paramanu, I'm existing, I'm present in every single atom and subatomic particles and the space between the subatomic particles. I'm present there. So every atom of creation is an embassy that is holding space. For God's presence. So how much can I consider this ordinary, profane? Every atom is oozing with the presence of God. As I like to say, in our tradition, our level of advancement will be measured according to our capacity to perceive God's presence in this world. Kanishta sees only God in the altar. Madhyam sees God in other people's heart. Uttam sees God everywhere. So we quote Prabhupada the other day, right? He said, Krishna is everywhere, and wherever he is, that's his temple. So everywhere is his temple. Every atom is a temple. The idea of going to the temple vanishes. I'm going to the temple. That means you are contacting any atom. Oh, that's a temple. Lokavatu Lila Kaivalyam, says the Vedanta Sutra. That's a beautiful aphorism which says the whole material creation is manifesting as a result of the bliss coming from God's heart. Krishna's experiences so much bliss that starts to overflow him. And the outpouring of that becomes this cosmos. That's Vedanta Sutra. That's not Swami Padmanabha's creation. I'm just referring to scripture because probably you are not believing me. So I'm trying to be as Shastric as possible. So Vedanta Sutra is saying that. The background for this creation is God's overflowing bliss. That's the backdrop of material creation. In mystical Christianity, they have a similar idea, with the idea of kenosis, God's self-emptying. God's emptying his heart, and that becomes this world, this cosmos. That is sacred. It is sacred. You ultimately, there are no profane things. That's the quote. Can I ask you, there is a copy still behind you of Radical Personalism? Sorry.
Yes.
Okay, I'll buy it. So I begin this, the last chapter of the book. The book, I call it, I try to make a play of words, as I always like to do. It's called Unearthing Heaven. Right? Unearthing, unearth, heaven. Sometimes we think heaven is there, right? Unearthing. How to discover, and the subtitle is How Material Energy Hosts the Spiritual World. Because we have the tendency, many times we are talking with people, and no, because when Krishna, and I asked, why you're pointing there? Why you are sending Krishna above the clouds?
Because he's Ganesha.
Okay, that's a legal explanation. Ganesha means Krishna has a color of the dark clouds. So we can point to the clouds. And not beyond your, why it's not in the immediate. Of course, God is transcendent, but God is also immanent. That's what Krishna says in the Gita, in the Bhagavad, I'm beyond everything, I'm inside everything. But many times, because Krishna, why are your hands going there? Why are you pushing Krishna so far from your life? Why don't you say Krishna?
Oh.
Krishna touching everyone's heart. Why Krishna? No? Of course, Krishna. No. Farther, farther, please. No? Don't mess up with my life too much. Keep a healthy distance. Sometimes we want that, actually. Right? We invite Krishna, but then when he invites himself too much, like, okay. You, above the clouds, I'm here. Your name is Ganashyam. You like clouds? Stay with the clouds for a while. I'm staying over here. Or the deities start to do some mischief, close the curtain. Do your stuff from the curtain inside. Don't become so much participative in my life. Let's go gradually. Anyhow, so the chapter is called An Earth in Heaven. And it begins with one nice quote from Wendell Berry. She says, there are no unsacred places. There are only sacred places and desecrated places.
What? Can you say desecrated in general?
No idea. So there are only sacred places and desecrated places. But there are no unsacred, profane places. And that's something that also I learned recently, which is very interesting. Sometimes we use this word profane, like the opposite of sacred, profane. But what it means profane, the word itself, profanum, coming from the Latin, means outside of the temple. And again, we were saying before, quoting Prabhupada, whatever Krishna is everywhere, wherever he is his temple. So everything is a temple. So profane means I'm living outside of the temple. I'm living outside of the consciousness that everything is sacred, that everything is a temple. Then things become profane because I am outside of the temple. I am not seeing the sacredness in everything. But in themselves, things are not profane. I'm just desecrating them by my lack of vision. And then you have the word contemplative or contemplation, contemplum, which means inside the temple. And again, it doesn't mean inside the temple physically, it's just to live a contemplative life means temple is everywhere, everything is sacred. A profane life is outside of the temple, nothing is sacred. So, and this is very present in our tradition. I like always to refer back to our Srimad Bhagavatam again, to be as orthodox as possible. And when Parikshit Maharaj is asking Sukadeva Goswami his main questions in the beginning, six questions, which may mostly have to do, okay, what to do with my life? What's the goal of life? I'm about to die. What's the highest duty of life? And Sukadeva Goswami, of course, will answer in installments. That's the whole Srimad Bhagavatam throughout 7 days. But how he begins his answer, he starts describing the Virat Rupa, which means see this universe, see this world as the body of God. Now he says the rivers are God's veins, right? The forest are God's bodily hairs. To try to learn to see the world in connection to the divine, establish some sambandha, some link, some bond between the two. Though Parikshit Maharaj never asked how to see this world, he said, what's the highest duty of life? And Sukadeva Goswami began there, like implying, first you have to get this lesson right. This is part of the answer to your question. How to get to the ultimate vision of life? Learn to see the world as divine. In the Balab Sampradaya and Pushtimari, I remember in my podcast, I invited a few scholars from the Pushtimari, and we were talking with one of them, Maitri Goswami, and she was telling me how in their tradition they begin first speaking about this world, then about the soul, then about God. That's the sequence. Now, let's first start with the most immediate concrete reality for most of us, material energy. And let's learn to see that in connection to the divine. Then we move to something more subtle, the self. And then we move to the super self. I appreciated the sequence. Because many times if we just try to make the quantum leap into Golok Vrindavan, so to say, we become like disassociated from, again, this body, this world, ungrounded. Now we are too concerned with us ascending and transcending. And maybe we need first to descend enough to be grounded. There is a copy of the other book, sorry if it sounds too self-referential. I like to read one section from that. Yeah, thank you, Dira. No subliminal promotion intended here. So I call this the last chapter of my, this is my last book, I call the last chapter The Depths of Matter, right? Because many times we think of matter as something without depth, just like superficial things, shallow, this is what it is. But there are depths of matter. Even if you are not a spiritualist, even let's say you are a purely secular scientist. If you are a real one, you know that matter is not what you think it is. There's way more to what we perceive in the surface. You just bring a small microscope and you just see any point and you realize, wow, what's going on here? Externally, it's no, this is not moving. This is inert. This is dead. Yeah, are you sure? Scratch the surface a little bit. There's vibration, there's frequency, and there's movement, and there is sound, there's song, there's dance, there's so much going on there. Right? And again, even if you are not a theist, just purely materialistic perspective, you will realize there is way more beyond the surface. So that's why I call the chapter the depths of matter. There matter has a depth also. So there's one section of the chapter that, again, I like play of words. So I call this matter matters. Right? Maybe you cannot make that play of words in German. Not in Spanish for sure. But matter matters. And it's interesting because in German, the word matter comes from the German matter, whatever. How do you say mother?
Mutter.
Okay, so the root for matter, material energy, comes from mother. So it's basically the same thing. So matter and mother, that's what we say, mother earth, mother nature, mother matter. It's a mother. So again, if you have a dysfunctional relationship with your mother, you know, it won't work very well. So you better heal your connection with mother in all its forms. So that's why it's so important for me to have a very healing relationship with matter. So let me show you two paragraphs, which is mostly some references to other sections of our tradition. So it says, all that exists, all, is intrinsically valuable. The more we internalize and embody this truth in the present moment, the closer we move toward wholeness. Recognizing the sacredness of matter becomes a vital pathway to transcendence. Our task is to unearth heaven, and go in there, for it begins here or nowhere at all. Sanatana Goswami's Brihadbhagavatamrita articulates this beautifully, asserting that perfection can be achieved by honoring even the smallest elements, such as a blade of grass, in its proper light. This one verse from Brihadbhagavatamrita. Sanatana Goswami said, if you relate to a blade of grass for what the blade of grass actually is, you can attain all perfection. Perfection is everywhere, Srila Siddhartha Maharaj will say. Perfection is waiting for you even in a blade of grass. Just that we are not looking attentively. So we gave today the example of the balls and the gorilla. The gorilla is perfection. It's moving in between. I don't see any gorilla. I was just too concentrated on counting the balls. Sometimes we are too concentrated in counting our rounds instead of chanting our rounds and meeting the gorilla of divine love coming to our lives. Sanatana Goswami also highlights, and in this section I'm pointing to Sanatana Goswami's Brihadbhagavatamrita, which by the way is the first book written in our tradition from Mahaprabhu's time onwards. Sanatana Goswami affirms that Krishna always lives everywhere, always, both within and without. Again, be careful with this, exiling Krishna, sending him to exile. Furthermore, he establishes that the spiritual world can manifest wherever one is. Vrindavan is a state of consciousness. And then say, one possible reason for this, as Brihadbhagavatamrita suggests, is that the earth, an expression of material energy, is the highest devotee of God. That's Brihadbhagavatamrita. The holiest devotee is right beneath our feet. So, yeah, these are all paradigm shifts for us to take a new perspective. How do we relate to the world of matter? How we relate to nature? How we honor whatever accompanies us in the day-to-day? And how we learn to discover Krishna in the immediate, again, in what seems ordinary, as we were talking yesterday. We don't need to wait for leaving this body or having something extraordinary happening. Even a blade of grass can give you all perfection, Sanatana Goswami says. If you have the eyes to see, like you go to the Bhagavatam, 11th canto, always I like to highlight that. There are 24 gurus mentioned there. That's a very interesting section. The 24 gurus of the Bhagavatam. From those 24, 21 are not human beings. Are all elements from nature. Earth, moon, wind, ocean, flowers, bumblebee, spider. Gurus, the main gurus of the Bhagavatam. Then we have three who are human beings. Okay, I accept that. Who are those three? A baby, a girl, a prostitute. End of the list. there you have your parampara, the Bhagavad parampara, so to say. So that's the point that the Bhagavatam, of course, I'm not saying outside of those 24 there are no gurus, but the Bhagavatam is making a point. And the first guru of those 24 is the earth. That's the one, number one, earth. Learn to see matter, the earth, as your guru. Learn something from it. Do not insult it. This damn planet, material world, they have to leave as soon as... No, no, it's a guru. You're rejecting a member of the parampara. And again, Bhagavatam gives shocking examples, right? A prostitute. Generally, we'll like, prostitute? Oh, I don't have anything to learn from that prostitute. Well, better you do, because there is guru everywhere. Ultimately, guru is everywhere. Krishna is everywhere, and Krishna is the original guru. Therefore, guru is everywhere. The disciple is missing in us. Because if we are a proper disciple, you will find guru everywhere. Srila Siddhartha Maharaj said, the goal is to enter into the land of gurus. The spiritual world is a land of gurus. Everything there is your guru. The soil, the wind, and every element is guru there. So we will all enter in the land of gurus as much as we start to find guru here everywhere. And we may have our specific gurus in life, but we should relate to them in a way that then after hearing from our gurus, then we start to see their extended presence everywhere else. And guru is everywhere at the end of the day. So matter is one of those. So, and you are supposed to venerate gurus, not to despise, mistreat, downplay. And today again, we are celebrating the Sannyas Leela of Sri Chaitanya, which in one sense is all about renunciation. But what's the renunciation of our tradition? Because as I say, many times in our history, we have read renunciation in very toxic ways, like escapism, rejection, indifference, or as a goal unto itself. The Bhagavatam says, Vasudevi Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojita Janayate Subhairagyam Gyanam Chayadahaitukam. Vairagyam becomes a byproduct of bhakti. By practicing devotion, you naturally get detached from the things that get in the way of devotion. And the things sometimes are the ways of thinking, ways of understanding. That's what we need to get detached from, mostly. So sannyas is not a rejection of the body. Sannyas is not a rejection of the world. No. Celebrating Mahaprabhu's sannyas is not about let's make a big party to reject this world. No. His renunciation is not rooted in contempt. Right? If you are a resentful renunciant, that's toxic. That's not healthy. That won't last. Yeah. If you are renouncing out of resentfulness, I'm rejecting this horrible thing. I'm renouncing. You're not renouncing anything. The more you resent something, the more it stays in your mind in a very toxic way. So for us, vairagya and renunciation is like the word indicates, vairagya. Vairagya. Ragya means raga. Raga means attachment. Vai means vaishishtya. A very special type of. To buy again is a very special type of attachment, which we translate as detachment. In other words, when you have a very special type of attachment, naturally some form of detachment comes out of that. Param drishta nivartante, Krishna says in the Gita. When you have a higher taste, you naturally release the lower taste. not with resentfulness, but welcoming a new level of perfection. Bhaktivinoda Thakur will say, today's perfection is tomorrow's imperfection. Tomorrow something new is waiting for me. I'm not resenting yesterday's perfection. I'm just letting that go for the sake of something bigger. So I'm not renouncing this out of resentfulness and bitterness and, oh, you're so bad. But with gratitude and thank you so much for all that happened. But now I'm ready for the next chapter of the journey. Follow my point? It's like if I talk to my mom and say, Mom, it was so nice when I was a baby and you were changing my diapers. Why let's not return there? And my mom hopefully will say, I trust you will say that. It was beautiful. And because it was beautiful, now we are ready for something even more beautiful. Let's honor that chapter by now moving to the next chapter, where I won't be changing your diapers. And nobody will. Hopefully you're not wearing that. But there's gratitude toward that chapter. But now we're moving forward. With gratitude, not with resentfulness, not with indifference. So that's vairagya. It's a moving forward in gratitude, not a rejection and indifference and resentfulness and escapism. Sometimes that happens. No? Sometimes people romanticize monastic life. Yeah, I will be monk and renounce the world and go. And 90% of those cases is sheer escapism. They have unresolved stuff unconsciously, no, without bad intention, but unconsciously they're escaping from wounds and unresolved stuff. And they think, oh, I go into the monastery, everything will magically. And after a few days, you realize, oops, oops, still here. So I have to do something with that. No? Like I remember famous monk, contemplative monk again, Thomas Merton. He was a contemplative monk. He lived in his hermit by himself for decades without living. So he had a nature for that. And he will say to many of the new aspirants coming with all this again romanticized idea of being a contemplative, like being an introvert, he say, doesn't mean that you're a contemplative. He will right away put that clear. Because you are an introvert, don't think that that means you can be a contemplative. Mm-hmm. So watch out for confusing all the things. Right? So vairagya again. Vairagya, we will say yukta vairagya. That's how Rupa Goswami qualified the idea of renunciation. Yukta vairagya. Yukta means balanced or healthy or proper renunciation. Ashakta savisayam yatartam upayunjata. Nirbandha Krishna Sambandha Yuktam Vairagyam Uchyate. So what does he defines renunciation for? What it is? To see everything in relationship with Krishna. So that's an interesting definition of renunciation. Because when we think renunciation, we think, what do I have to renounce? He's giving a positive definition. He's saying, see everything in relationship with Krishna. That's a renunciation. In other words, renounce to any vision that opposes that, which is not easy. In one sense, it's easier to put a loincloth, grow dreadlocks, put ash all over my body, and go to a cave. In one sense, that's easier than living the mentality of things revolve around me. That's more difficult. But something that can help is engage everything in service to the center. And when you do that, there's nothing to fear, nothing to escape, nothing to reject. Everything becomes very, very divine. Everything shows itself for what it is. As Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur shockingly says here, have you brought your seatbelt to fasten? Okay.
Yes.
Okay, it begins right away. He says, this universe is full of objects for the service of the master of this universe. So this universe is full of paraphernalia to offer to Bhagavan. So we don't need to go anywhere, basically. Therefore, even more shocking, all those objects are adorable. Not even venerable, adorable, which is even more cute, right? When you adore someone, more intimate. So all the objects of this world are adorable. Each of the material elements are truly favorable for Krishna's pastimes. Imagine. And most of us are like, this is an obstacle, this is getting in the way, I need to leave this place. But why? Each of the material elements are truly favorable for Krishna's pastime. No wonder he comes to earth over and over again to perform his lila. And that is why when we perform artic, the various elements that make up this world, earth, water, fire, ether, are represented there in the incense, lamp, etc. In other words, this world is potential paraphernalia to be used in the service of the Lord. And thus such items will be first offered to him and only newly honored by us. So this arti plate, right, with incense, lamp, that's a symbolic representation of material creation, because material creation is made up of earth, water, fire, either combined in different degrees. So all those elements are in the plate. So that's a symbolic representation of the world of matter. Well, what do we do with that? We offer in service to Bhagavan, and then we honor the prasad. So there's the whole world is a big arti plate. If you want to follow the analogy. The whole of creation is a huge arti plate.
Yeah.
So again, the question is how we are interacting with that.
Can I ask just very briefly?
Yeah.
Because Vincent Prabhu said then it's also prasadam. But then if we have this view that the word is prasadam, then we can forget that actually it's an offering, no?
Yeah, for me, the
slippery slope.
Yeah, I will say that in principle, as we say, material energy is already engaged in service of Krishna. I mean, from a very essential perspective, we may not have that view. I may not have that view, but from the very essence, matter is already dedicated to serve Krishna. So in that sense, we could say it's already prasad. We are not prasad yet. So I'm not offered myself yet. So by offering matter to Krishna, ideally I'm offering myself. Because at the end of the day, I am the offering. That's the realization I should reach some point. Bhakti is not about offering things to, I mean, doing things and then offering them to Krishna. Bhakti is offering myself to Krishna and then doing things. This is the hierarchy in the Gita. If you go chapter 9, verse 26, 27, there's a hierarchy there. First comes the higher idea, then the lower idea. First higher idea, patram pushpam phalam tuyam yomi bhaktya prayajati. Krishna says, flower, fruit, as we say yesterday, leaf, water, doesn't matter. Bhakti. You are the offering. Your heart. I want that loving offering. Then the second verse implies kind of, well, if you cannot do this, and there are many verses in the Gita like that, in chapter 12, Krishna said, always think of me, if you cannot do this, if you cannot do that, this, if you cannot do that, you have to begin somewhere. So next verse, Krishna says, yat karoshi dat yat asnasi yat yuvasi dat asi yat yat tapasasi kanti yat tat kuru shramadarapanam. Whatever you do, whatever you offer, whatever austerities you perform, offer them to me. So that's a step back, actually. You do things, and then you offer them to him. The previous verse is, offer yourself to him. And then you do anything. You offer me a drop of water. It doesn't matter, Krishna said. But you are the offering. So I think that's an important point to bear in mind. We are the offering. Even when we are offering something, it's for the sake of us being the offering. This flower, this boga, is helping me to offer myself. Swaha. Like when you say swaha, you think, okay, I'm offering rice to the fire. Not the grain of rice is representing you. What does it mean, swaha? Swaha, myself. I offer myself there. But of course, it could be a little bit shocking if I just jump into the fire. So I throw a grain of rice. But that grain symbolizes I'm the offering. So let's conclude with one more point that I want to share with you in connection to who we are talking, because the whole theme today, of course, is the sacredness of matter, but specifically in connection to the body, which again, it's a great facilitator here in many ways. And I will briefly touch upon this point because, of course, this deserves a seminar unto itself, a separate retreat, which is sexuality. And of course, here you have a sannyasi speaking about sexuality. I'm giving the clarification, the disclaimer. I don't have practical experience of what I'm talking about. But I've witnessed and seen enough, I would say, to have an idea, and I think I can say something. So in my book, Radical Personalism, there is a chapter called Radical Sexuality, which may sound a little scary at the time. Again, remember what's radical, radical mean, right? So
please remind us, what does radical mean?
Something done to the root, to its essence. So not to an extreme in a degraded way, but understand approaching something in its essential, in its root aspect, to its core. So I briefly introduce the chapter. I won't torture you with the whole chapter, just introduction. And I put, and this book in big part is a loving critique to my own tradition, because I love it. So I dare to criticize it because I love it. Nowadays, Gaudiya Vaishnavism is possessed with a serious case of erotophobia. Fear of the erotic. We need to make peace with this reality and stop fearing sexual expression, attacking it and stigmatizing its practice and implications. We need to understand sexuality more organically, not only by establishing its purposes and boundaries, but especially by avoiding shallow denial and detrimental repression. We call this radical sexuality. So again, sexuality in itself is not bad. We wouldn't be here if not for that. So we always am grafted to that to begin with. And sexuality, of course, goes beyond the mere biological physical act. Of course, that's one expression of it, but there is something in our tradition called Kriya Shakti, or creative energy. So it's an energetic department within each one of us, including monks. No. So I can say, as a monk, I have sexual energy or creative energy, which I have to do something with that. Right? It's not like, oh, I'm a monk, so I have nothing to do with that energetic department. So I will cancel that. Oof, that's not a good choice, because so we can understand sexuality in the, I mean, I have to, if I want to keep my bowels in order, healthy way. How to understand sexuality alternatively? You can understand sexuality as intimacy, as connection, as creativity. Ideally, even a physical, biological, sexual act should be accompanied by those elements. Because if not, we are using sexuality as escapism. Vulnerability, we talked the other day. I think we talked on the table these days about that at one point after lunch. No? Sexuality is very vulnerable. You are naked in front of the other person. That's vulnerable, to be naked. Generally, we don't go naked through life, because we will feel like Adam and Eve covering. I don't want to see naked. So to be seen in our nakedness, that's very vulnerable. So to do that from a healing, healthy place, that requires lots of courage and trust. So again, as a monk, I'm not engaging biologically in sexuality, but I have to culture vulnerability, intimacy, connection, express my creativity in different ways, in my relationships. So I have no excuse to escape all the things because I'm a celibate monk. Still, I have to know what to do with it. And as I like to say, my personal opinion, and I know not everyone may agree with me, but I don't think that the only possible healthy way of expressing physical sexuality is for procreation. As I said, you can engage with your partner in a committed relationship in the context of intimacy and connection. Intimacy is not a bad word, right? Sometimes people hear intimacy like, ooh, intimacy. Because we are very much disconnected from, we don't have too much emotional intimacy. We are not very intimately connected with our own emotions. So someone says intimacy and we are triggered with that word. Because it's a mirror. It's reminding us probably our lack of intimacy with our own selves. What to speak, relate to other people intimately. It feels scary. So we need to cultivate emotional intimacy, every form of intimacy, closeness. So I will personally say that, yeah, you can express sexuality in a committed relationship in a way that fosters intimacy and connection and creativity. And it can be sacred. It can be connecting deep. Of course, this is not to cheaply justify, just have sex wildly. Again, that's the other extreme. The two extremes of the pendulum, right? Repression and denial. And the other extreme, using sexuality and escapism. All your unresolved stuff, your lack of intimacy, you, as I speak in the book, you eroticize trauma. All your trauma, you bring them to the bed, so to say. And that's why sometimes there is so much abuse and so much violence in the name of sex. But that's not the healthy expression of it. Properly expressed, it has to be healing, like any other thing properly expressed. Let me go to a deep point, esoteric, but we cannot deny it in our tradition. Radha and Krishna have sexual life on a daily basis. Sorry. And not for procreation. Whoops. What to do with that? Yeah, it's Radha and Krishna. We are not Radha and Krishna. Yeah, of course. But you have to do something with that. And that union is the zenith of their lilas. The zenith, the height, not the high point.
No? Is that why the gopis follow Krishna?
Sorry again?
Is that why the gopis follow Krishna?
Follow Krishna?
Follow him, yeah. Seek him. I'm making a very bad joke.
No, it's fine. Relax. No problem. I mean, of course, again, we will quick to clarify that sexual union is not, it's not ordinary, it's not selfish, but it's still there. It's a symbol of connectivity. It's a symbol of intimacy. It's a symbol, not only a symbol, but it represents all these values that somehow are reflected in this sexual union between human beings also. No? Someone say, well, but that lila is, but that sexual union is transcendental. So then you are affirming that there is place for sexual union as long as it's transcendental. So what do you mean by transcendental? If you say, okay, it's free from selfishness and exploitation, and it's done as an act of service and connection and intimacy, okay, so there is place then for sexuality being transcendental among human beings. And not necessarily seeing that as degrading, necessarily degrading, entangling stuff. Of course, it can be if improperly expressed, as it can be anything else, right? You can be entangled in sexual life and you can be entangled in power and fame and prestige and while being a celibate. And you can fall into the dark well of family life as you can fall in the dark well of monastic life. There's always a dark well in every place, but it's not that that life is a dark well in itself, right? We may have here in this property, we may have a dark well. It doesn't mean that the whole property is a dark well. there is a dark well somewhere. Watch out, don't fall there. You
have two.
Pay attention. But I will say, oh, this place we are sitting now is such a dark well. Oh, it's beautiful. But there is some dark well somewhere, so just watch out. So family life is not a dark well, it's an ashram. We will say in our tradition, ashram. Ashram means comes from ashraya, means shelter. So you can be having your family, and that's a shelter. Sanyas ashram, Brahmacharya, all these are shelters. We are supposed to take shelter in them. It's not a dark well. Unless we leave them from a toxic place, from a place of escapism, from a place of denial of all the needs to be healed. But if a sadhaka, if a practitioner is engaging in a healthy sexual exchange with a partner in a committed relationship, and that creates connectivity and intimacy and union and keeps our humanity in balance, and from that foundation, you can practice a balanced spiritual life, why not calling that transcendental? I'm not making a full parallel with Radha and Krishna, who can, but we don't need to go to the other extreme either. Because then probably you will have 90% of marriages ending up in divorce, as we say the statistics before. No. Too artificial and forced detachment, and I'm not supposed to be human, I'm supposed to be transcendental. Our transcendence includes full humanity. Radha and Krishna are in their Nara Lila, means fully human Lila. They're fully human, not us yet. We sometimes are more inhuman than human. But Radha and Krishna, they're human and divine. I'm not denying the divine part, but I'm not denying the human part either. And that's what makes their Lila so charming and so relatable, because they speak to our humanity. So we have to keep our humanity in place so we can relate to the human Lila of Radha and Krishna. The more inhuman we become, the more we won't relate to their human Lila. So especially because we want so badly to enter into that human Lila, we have to honor and keep our humanity in place, which in part means honoring our body also, and seeing that with sacredness. So some thoughts before inviting you for one more exercise. Why not? Kamaniya can stay there, no problem. She's taking in practice what I'm saying now. You have to honor your body, it needs rest, it needs repose. After the exercise. This is another one.
Sorry, I was fighting my body.
It's fine. It's part of honoring our body. Again, body's a temple. Body needs cleaning. Body needs resting. It's all part of the same dance, no? Productivity, restoration, different currents of the same thing. One to rest, one to act. It's okay. It's fine. Shyamalal Prabhu?
Yes, I do have.
What, a question?
Yes.
Can we go to questions after the exercise?
Oh, I thought you were. No, I apologize.
No, don't need to apologize. I'm just asking if you are patient enough or No, it's fine.
Okay.
A short exercise, it won't take long.
Yeah.
And then we go to a few questions, if it's okay. I will pause the recording. No, I will keep the recording and let you know what the exercise is about in case someone is then watching and want to make it. So we're forming groups of three. We'll see if we can count some. We can make two, one, three. We'll make two groups of three, two groups of two. They are coming, both of them? Okay, so then we'll be able to do groups of three. Great. Let's see. Indira is coming, Keshavacharya?
Huh?
Indira is coming?
Oh, should I come there? Yes.
Is she come? Come? Why not? What did she say?
She's no, I don't know what. She's nine, she can decide.
That's okay, it's okay. No problem. So we'll group the groups of three and one group of two, it's fine. So what we'll do in this exercise is Each of us will have a turn to be seen and affirmed in our embodiment. Mm-hmm. Not for performance, not for appearance, I'm so look so nice, so cool, not from that place, but as sacred vessels. No? And the other two will practice offering reverence to that. So how it will take place? 2-3 minutes per person, and we will shift turns. So the first speaker, the one who will be honored, so to say, you have to share briefly, again, 2-3 minutes. I will be there with my bell reminding you. Please honor conciseness. And you can mention 2-3 things that you appreciate about your body. But no need to say, I'm so beautiful and I'm so, not in that direction. You can say, okay, my body allows me to walk, allows me to see, allows me to serve, even allows resting, breathing, even some problems my body has and is teaching me certain lessons, whatever. But no, not in the need of, I look so wonderful and I'm more pretty than anyone. No need to go there. So you can mention 2-3 things you are appreciating about your body, you are learning, right? 2-3 minutes each person. And the listeners, of course, are listeners. So you are, as we practice today, open, receiving, listening, being present. And maybe after the sharing, the two listeners can share some one line of affirmation, like something like, I honor your body as a temple, no? Or your body is sacred just as it is. Some brief affirmation, whatever you feel inspired to say, affirming the reality of the body as sacred. And then comes the rotation. Second person will do the same, the other two will listen, and then a short affirmation, and then the third one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And after, at the end, we will do an integration, one moment where everyone finished. So the group of three or two, depending on the group, the three of you can sit in silence for a moment. And maybe if it helps, you can touch your heart or your belly, your body, and maybe repeat inwardly, like, this body is my temple. No? What we are trying to tell that to you. No need to tell that to anyone, but just for a few moments in silence, each one will do some affirmation in that connection. It's okay?
2 or 3 minutes for each person.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And at the end, this few, I will play the bell and invite each one to enter into silence and for a moment connect with your body and affirm the sacredness of it. I will put pause. Oh, thank you for being willing and open to all my social experiments. And I hope they're helping to be more grounded into all the theory and information and make that more experiential, because at the end of the day, the things are understood through direct experience. So before concluding, since also Indira told me Prashad is ready, I have a few minutes if anyone has question or something that you wanted to share. Shamlal, Natalia also raised her hand, so Dato Darshini as well. We may not have too much time, but as much as we can. So
I'm not sure exactly how these all connect, but they're just I'm not sure exactly how all they fit, but I'm just curious if you could please comment on the idea of when the child comes out of the womb, that they cry, mm-hmm. in meeting the material world and coming into mm-hmm. Earth. And the idea of Adam and Eve, how does that work? How does that play into the issue of repression and how that works in terms of sinfulness? And the other part of it is, I'm kind of struggling to express this, but you know, how do we deal with all the conflict? Why are there conflicts, and how, in through the river of our lives, how those boulders and those rocks, why do they get in the way, and why do we experience these conflicts? And
there are 17 questions there, basically. I'll say something, but I do not promise too much. I have Indira downstairs dinner ready, and I have 17 questions and 3 more questioners waiting for me. Yeah, or you can speak with Indira and beg for her patience. I don't know. I'm in between, they say, a rock and a hard place. But I will say that the crying of a child is not necessarily something to be taken negatively to begin with. I take it as a way of affirming your identity through sound. Like, here I am, I exist. Is it like a primal affirmation of my own self-identity? I exist. And sound, how crucial sound is to help us affirm our identity. And still now, we resort to sound in mantra and prayer. It's a way of affirming who we actually are. And Prabhupada, not surprised, he will describe the chanting of the Maha Mantras, the crying of a child. And so then we have some connection in a positive way to see a crying, you know? Like the very first sound that comes. Affirming our identity, of course, also affirming, okay, I'm coming in this human form. What's the ultimate purpose of this human form? It's longing for divine connection. So if the crying sets the idea clear. Maybe we forget in time why we, but that points into which direction we are supposed to live our life in a way that we end up crying and longing for the divine in a sacred way. You know, there are different tiers. As for Adam and Eve, somehow the story is generally given as an analogy of course, it can be read in so many ways. The way I present it is it represents the frailty of human existence and sometimes the shame that comes when we gain self-awareness of our frailty, our vulnerability, and we tend to hide and to cover ourselves. And as the story says, not only they hid, but interestingly, God is described as sewing clothes for them, right? Like seeing that they were so desperate to cover themselves, and God didn't say, "You are so coward, just show yourself naked. Come on, get out of that hidden place. Be vulnerable." Say, okay, I can understand it feels frail, it feels dangerous. I will make some clothes for you. Okay, cover yourself, feel protected. Eventually, gradually we will have to be naked properly, but in front of the divine. But he understands our fear, so he's supporting our journey. That's as much as I can say today, reply. Because then the other 15 questions, maybe. Let's see, these days we have some more time. Let's have hope. Let's move to Natalia and then to Tato Darshani. Indira, a few more minutes downstairs.
I remember that you yesterday talked about or give us an example of the alcoholics.
Yeah.
So now when we were talking, I thought that how maybe as less alcoholics, but it's not literal, but it's not literal, but as when we became as devotees, sometimes part of our past is left behind because it's what we pass in order to become as devotees, but how in that past we can look for Krishna look for Buska, how
search
for Krishna in the in our own history and in our own past, that maybe when we begin of being devotees we forget or we leave behind.
Well, thank you. Okay, if I understood correctly, what Natalia is asking is, okay, sometimes when one becomes a devotee, whatever that means, when we join, somehow we leave behind our past, or we think we are supposed to do that. And now I'm a devotee. And so past, my past story, my past life, my past stuff, now I'm a devotee. So how can we, as devotees, if I understood correctly, you tell me if I'm wrong, how can we honor our past? What to do with our past as devotees? Is that to be just dismissed, erased? And can we move forward? I don't know. I'm getting that clear.
And how Krishna in that past too.
How to see Krishna present in that past too. Okay.
In the past before we came to
Yeah. So of course all these are good questions, great questions, and we need separate retreats for each question. And we will have eternity to explore all that in time. So that's good. I will agree that maybe in the beginning when we join not only this practice with any spiritual movement or something, we tend to dissociate from the other things that maybe we are running away from. Because many times we join, as Krishna says in the Gita, we start practicing spirituality because we are suffering so much and we want to stop suffering. So we are basically running away from something. And it's okay. We find something that gives us some hope and clarity and support. But it doesn't mean that we have fully integrated and healed and solved everything of our past wounds. In the beginning, it feels like that. Oh, honeymoon period. And it's okay. There is place for being in honeymoon, right? But then the honeymoon is over. And you realize, oh, I still have this and this, and my partner has that. So you have to work on that. So I think it's good eventually that we realize spiritual life is not an escape from my past or escape from my childhood or escape from my trauma or escape from my wounds or escape from my unresolved stuff, but actually it's a way to deal with them, to heal them, to integrate them, to confront them in a healthy way. So we can look back as practitioners to our past. Again, not excessively to miss the present, because also that's a temptation. You can be spending too much time looking at the past and you are forgetting that the present is the only place you can actually exist. But we can reflect on the past, and with certain knowledge and experience and proper guidance and support, hopefully, we can start to see God's presence in our past in ways that we were not able to see at that time. No, maybe we were seeing, oh, this was traumatizing, and it was. I'm not saying that certain things were not, but how God's presence was in my life, even in the midst of a traumatizing experience. Because if I'm going through suffering, that's mean that God was not there, right? It's not that Krishna is only when things go nice. He's unconditionally present. And so it may be easier for us to, oh yeah, God is here because everything is working perfectly. No, but especially try to discover God in the cracking. Oh, like this famous song of Leonard Cohen, I look for the crack, that's where the light gets in, right? So, and of course I'm talking in general here, not giving any specific advice to anyone, because each one has their own path and experiences, and some situations from the past can be very intense, and we have to be very skillful in how we navigate that. It's not just let's jump there and I will hear Krishna's flute, and not, maybe not. But I will say that it's good that as a practitioner we can enough, not in excess, but look back at our past and be grateful. And in the sense that at least to say, all that helped me to be where I am now. No? And that doesn't mean that where I am now is the final product, but somehow all those situations became part of my story. And without each one of those situations, without any of those situations, I wouldn't be here now with you talking. So all those situations were instrumental in us being here today sharing what we are sharing. You take out one of those, probably we will be somewhere else or someone else. So I think it's always healthy to look at the past with gratitude. And of course, acknowledging difficult situations, but then going back to the present moment and trying to say, okay, well, how can I heal that wound in the here and now, and how can invoke Krishna's presence there, and try to develop this relationship with the divine so we can have an experience of the mercy of God to the point that you realize, yeah, Krishna is unconditionally present in every moment of my life. At least I personally have had that experience, especially in the most difficult moments. If you open yourself to Krishna entering your life, oof, that will be very evident. He will really be there to compensate for the loss, for the betrayal, for the whatever. Some thoughts. I hope that helps. Again, it's always general questions, not specific cases, because that requires more detailed information. So we'll conclude with Tattva Darshini.
I had just I'm surprised because I didn't raise my hand, but you probably felt that I had the desire of sharing one thing.
No, I never say Patrick.
Which
is fine. That's fine.
I will take 1 minute because I wanted to.
Tattva Darshini reads minds. Let's put it
exactly
clearly.
But when sharing, because when Shanran said about the kids coming to the world and crying, I want just to share the experience of Axel when he came to the world. It was the most beautiful experience because it was, I mean, a process, obviously, for my wife and I. And Axel was born in a flat in Canada. We rented a flat. We had a small pool. So he was born just with the, how you call it, the doula? Doula?
Doula, yeah.
Yeah.
Midwife.
He came home and he was born into the pool. Katya got it immediately. I got it from the water. She got it on the chest. He didn't open his mouth. He didn't make cry. Nothing. It was amazing. So it was. We just shared.
Okay.
I didn't want to take time.
Some alternative version. But be careful not. Don't to think also because he's crying, then it's worse than if he's not crying. It's beautiful in both ways. Right? Yes.
It's not a must that
Is he a vine now? So Tattva Darshini.
Yeah, I'm very thankful for your explanations making this paradigm shift. And I felt during these explanations and also with this exercise becoming very, it was very soothing, and I became very peaceful, and I realized, yes, I'm part of something really big. Everything is Krishna. I can love, but I'm also loved. So this was really something, wow, new for me. But then came also to my mind, well, the Shastras and our Acharyas stress very much that we should not too much enjoy, we should make tapasya, and especially for me, I'm struggling. Sometimes I feel like maybe also women, especially, it makes us also hard. And so how to deal with this? Because for me at the moment, it feels like very opposite. With this tapasya, I'm not able anymore to perceive this love or to, so how to deal with this?
You have a very good question. Thank you. Well, tapasya is a Sanskrit word that sometimes is translated as austerity or penance. But again, sometimes it's misread. Now, like, okay, you have to exhaust yourself or make like excessive effort or stop eating or not sleeping and whatever. And Krishna says in the Gita, chapter 6, you have to be balanced in your eating, in your sleeping, in your recreation, as I say the other day. We are not against enjoyment. Enjoyment is not a bad word. It just when it becomes selfish and exploitative and dangerous, that's not enjoyment technically. Because if I try to enjoy at the expense of everyone else and everyone else is suffering and miserable, how can I call that enjoyment? So it's so-called enjoyment. But actual enjoyment, we have nothing against it. What we are doing, that I'm enjoying here being with you. And I don't think we should feel bad about it, right? You should feel bad because you are enjoying. You should be feeling miserable. So that's correct because you won't be enjoying that. Right. And Prabhupada said many times. You know, someone asked him if even like I don't know. Sometimes for tapasya or this, just austerity is related to for example, fasting, not eat, do not eat or eat less. And if someone asks him, is Ekadashi, the day, 2 days a month we fast for grains, is about fasting? I said, no, Ekadashi is about feasting. No, it's feasting, and what's the point? It's about, there are 2 days a month that we try to dedicate ourselves deeply to Krishna. So that's the feasting, ideally. Oh, I can give myself more, especially with a special presence. Oh, that's a feast. And the fasting, as much as I dedicate myself, maybe if I absorb too much in that dedication, I may forget to eat. But the fasting should be like an, how to say, unperceived consequence of the feasting. If I love someone too much and I'm very dedicated to love that person, probably I forgot to eat. That's how the fasting should happen. Not like I'm all day thinking I'm fasting. I'm so hungry. I don't have to eat this. I shouldn't be doing. That's not tapasya. That's torture. And the word tapasya, actually, which is a very interesting word, which is translated austerity, that's the first comes tapas. And that's the very first word that sounds in the universe, according to the Bhagavata. That's the first word that Brahma is hearing when he's sitting and trying to find his way, what to do with my life, going down the lotus, how do you call?
Stem.
What to do, nothing over, it never ends. Let's go back, at least I have some safety on the lotus flower. But still bewildered, what to do, it's only me. It's only me and an endless lotus flower. What to do? And he hears the word tapas, which in Sanskrit, tapas means fire. Fire. So what does Brahma do when he hears fire? He doesn't light the candle. He doesn't bring two sticks. And fire was created for the first time. He closes his eyes and looks inside, becomes introspective. So he understood fire, tapas, or tapasya, as introspection. And then he received all the necessary answers he was looking for. So ultimately, tapasya means introspection, means looking inside. It doesn't mean stop eating and sleeping and overexert yourself. Of course, sometimes we cannot go beyond our limits in some situations. Like we were talking the other day when we did this Govardhan Dandavat Parikram with Narayani and another team. I was going beyond my physical limits, I can tell you. That was exhausting. But I knew how much I could go beyond that to the point that it didn't become violence to this temple, the body. Because if not, this was the point, right? But I remember one day, because Jai Jagannath Prabhu, and he will forgive me for exposing him publicly here, he's my friend, he was organizing the retreat, and we were planning every day we will do this amount of distance during the Dandavat Parikram. And generally it was like a few kilometers per day, which doesn't sound too much walking, but if you do like this, that takes some time. But I think it was this third day, he miscalculated the distance, and we ended up doing almost double. But nobody knew. And we were wondering, when is this over? No, because we are doing, I mean, we were told it was the normal distance, but we are almost double time, and it's never, we are not reaching the point. And then we realized, oh, he miscalculated. But we still did that. But of course, the next day, at least personally, I couldn't walk. My whole body was like collapsed. So I felt, I cannot go. I cannot force myself to go. That would be more like an ego thing. I have to do it no matter what. And my body is begging for mercy, so to say. I remember I told him, I'm not going physically. I will join you mentally. I told him I will be meditating, chanting and meditating this distance you are going, the place you're visiting, and joining you in that way. But my body cannot go. And he told me something very beautiful in three words. He said, yes, Maharaj, you have to honor your limitations. No, honor your limitations. No. Many times we shame ourselves because of our limitations, which doesn't mean be lazy. Just when you reach the limit, your limit, and you see I've reached my limit, honor that. Don't try to keep pushing and pushing to a point that becomes toxic, harm, self-harmful. So again, tapasya should be something that pushes out of our comfort zone, no? But not that much either, that we start to become paranoid. No? Like I remember one friend drew three circles, which was, that was funny, in connection to this, three circles, right? One bigger than the circle, the smallest comfort zone. No? So there's no tapasya in comfort zone. Let's put it that way. But tapasya means something that the second circle is learning zone.
Mm-hmm.
No? And the third circle was panic zone. So you don't want to end up in the panic zone. It's too unknown. It's too much outside my comfort zone. I'm going crazy. It's too much tapasya. But you don't want to get stuck in the comfort zone, where there's no challenge, no growth, no effort. You want to get the middle point, again, the balance, the learning zone. It's challenging. It's unsettling, uncomfortable, but in a sustainable level. So when we speak about tapasya, when our acharyas speak about that, they are speaking about that type, that degree of tapasya. Sustainable, because what's the point of you over exert yourself and after 1 week you want to run away from the whole thing? I mean, that was not the idea of tapasya. Tapasya has to be insightful. Well, again, Brahma, her tapas, enter into inner world introspection, learning zone. He had an insight. And he then proceeded. So again, if we're talking today in the morning, we have to know where we are, how much we can go, honor our limitations, acknowledge our adhikar. Do not be lazy, complacent, but do not be excessive in our sacrifice to a point that becomes self-centered also. There may be two sides of the same coin. So try to find the middle path, which generally is the most difficult because we tend to go to the pendulum, right? So how to stay in the... And the middle path can be different every day. What's middle path today? Tomorrow maybe more like an extreme. So I have to refine my middle path, my middle point today. You follow my point? Like for me, with the example of the Dandavat Parikram. Okay, for me, one day, go out of the comfort zone was to do the whole thing in excess, twice what I was expected to do. It was hard, it was hurtful, but I say, okay, I will do it. Now the next day, I couldn't do it. So I had to reestablish my middle point today. For today, it will be hurtful to wake up and go to the bathroom. That's my tapasya today, to walk to the bathroom. Because that's in itself was hurtful. Previous day, tapasya was something else. So every day we have to be open and willing to ask, okay, what's the limitation today? To move beyond the comfort zone, not into the panic zone, but into the learning zone. I don't know if that helps.
Yes, very much. Yeah, I call it the stretching zone. So
okay.
It's a bit stretch, but
yeah.
Then yeah. I can still move it.
Thank you.
The burnout zone be beyond the panic zone? I'm asking very seriously because I'm dealing with the effects of burnout.
Yeah, probably. I mean, burnout is kind of a symptom that one has gone too far, so to say. One has gone too far, too much. So, again, it's an invitation to learn restoration as service also. Again, service is not just productivity to the point of burnout, but it's also balance, restoration and healing, self-love, self-care. All that can be service. So yeah, if we are feeling burnout, sincerely, we are not creating that as an excuse not to do our part. We need to pay attention to that. Because I think we all know, we all have gone through that, and we all seen people who have burned out so considerably, even in spiritual terms, that they just don't want anything to do with that because, oh no, that's burnout. I don't want to join that cult again. It was not a cult, but maybe we practiced to a point of self-demand that was not healthy. So we need to, yeah, to have that. Again, tapas means introspection. So it's interesting because tapas, again, it's not mean push too much to the point of burnout, but be introspective so you avoid the burnout. But being introspective is a form of effort and sacrifice. Sometimes it's easier not to be introspective, but the price for that is you burn out. So then you are invited to do the tapasya of really having a discernment on a daily basis to prevent the burnout, to prevent the comfort zone excessively, but to prevent the panic zone, the burning out zone. Yeah. And that requires daily vigilance. And nobody else can do that for us also. So we have to take responsibility for our own journey. Okay, it's 8 p.m. I think we can put the sharing to rest. And tomorrow morning, since we have been talking today about body as a temple, once we have made some peace with ourselves and with our body, maybe tomorrow we can approach Krishna without projecting all our own unresolved stuff, so to say, and to him. And we'll be talking about that tomorrow, about the ever-evolving God and rethinking God through the lens of love. I will go back to one of the main themes from my recent book and how we can think of the divine as an ever-evolving personality that invites us to for a daily rediscovery of who Krishna is, who Radha is, and a rediscovery of ourselves in the context of that. So see you for that tomorrow morning, 11 a.m. on the last quote unquote, there will be always some. Let's keep the door hopeful door open for the future. Srimad Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Sri Radha Murli Dharju ki jai, Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai, Sadhu Sangha ki jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Hari Bol, Vancha Kalpataru Vishya, Vasindhu Bhevach, Titanam Pavane Pyu Vishnavi Bhiru.